Hello and welcome to this WILL radio special, Illinois at the Oscars. I'm Jeff Bossert. The film Whiplash was made without the promise of wide-scale distribution. On Sunday, it could take home as many as 5 Academy Awards, and its producer, Helen Estabrook, grew up in Champaign-Urbana. She joins us by phone from her offices in California. Thanks so much for joining us, Helen, and congratulations on the Oscar nominations.
Thank you so much.
First, I'd like to talk about growing up in Champaign and attending Uni High. In your early years, did you plan on then going into film?
You know, I did, actually. I did a lot of theater as a kid and in high school, too. And I knew sort of theater or film is where I wanted to end up, ideally.
Growing up in this region, were there aspects of the Champaign-Urbana community or particular memories that had any influence in directing you toward that kind of career?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, I was saying to someone about this the other day, I think that the beauty of Champaign-Urbana is that you have this sort of safety of a smaller town with the culture of a bigger city. And I think that I was really lucky to be exposed to a lot of great things when I was young, both the plays that I was able to do, but also the plays I was able to see, and sort of seeing the various things that, you know, whether it's, you know, Krannert or Parkland or all of the different places, the Station Theater, that are doing cool and interesting things. And I felt very lucky to be exposed to that at a very early age.
So you attended Harvard and graduated with a degree in sociology. How does that translate into a career in film?
Well, I went to Harvard, first of all, because they don't have a theater program. And I wanted to be able to do theater, but I didn't want to major in it because I wanted to be able to study other things and make sure that I wasn't getting my focus too narrowed at an early age. So I was able to do a lot of theater there without actually having a degree in it, which was, I think, lucky for me.
And how soon did you figure out you wanted to be more behind the scenes rather than on the stage or in front of the camera?
You know, the thing is, my freshman year of college, when I had a friend who was directing a play who asked me to stage manage, and I had, you know, always thought that I wanted to be an actress just because that was what I was most exposed to, but realized after doing a play the fall of my freshman year that that was probably not where my strengths were and probably not what interested me as much. And so I stage managed a play and really fell in love with it there. And I think that it was the sort of being a part of every aspect of the production was what really excited me most.
Well, in your role as a film producer, you get more scripts sent to you than you can possibly produce. What made Whiplash stand out to you when you first received the script?
It was one of the best things that I've ever read, honestly. It is a very specific story, and it felt very familiar to me in a way that was sort of strange and funny because I've never quite had a mentor like Terrence Fletcher. But just the sort of themes and ideas that it was exploring, I felt very connected to. And it was just really well written. I think that, unfortunately, the majority of things that you read are just not well articulated in that way. And Damien is just an incredible talent, and it's very clear when you read anything of his.
When you say Damien, we're talking about Damien Chazelle, the director of the film. And what did you see in him that made you feel confident that he could helm this project?
When he was in college, he made a movie called Guy and Madeline on a park bench. And I actually just by coincidence, saw it at the Tribeca Film Festival in 2007. And I didn't quite know what to make of it then because it's this very strange and beautiful black and white tap dancing musical. But it was very clear just even from that this guy had a real eye and a real voice and was clearly a very talented director. And so when I got the script, I sort of had that information already that he was at least doing something very interesting and different. And then as soon as you talk to him, you just know he has such a clear articulation of his vision and what he's thinking of and what he sees that it becomes very easy to support because you know exactly what you're getting into.
So, you know, what do you typically look for in a film, and how did Damien typify that?
I think that anything that feels unique, you know, I think that there are there's a lot of things that you feel have been done before in movies, and I think that, you know, there's still a lot of ideas to explore, and there's sort of a lot of interesting ways to do it, and I think that Damien is a perfect example of that because he wrote a movie that could be on the page a very sort of small drama, but he wanted to shoot it in a new and different way that felt like a thriller, that felt like a sports movie, that felt like all of these bigger things. And I think that that's the real trick. I tend to like stories that are sort of smaller, meaning I'm not as enamored by superhero movies just as far as things that I want to make. I definitely like watching them, but the things that I want to make tend to be a bit smaller, but you need something to elevate it. You need something to make it make it worth going to see in a theater. And I think that that's something that Damien is really good at doing, is sort of telling these very personal stories, but in a way that fills the screen.
Well, one thing that's different about Whiplash is the pre-production process. And you did a short film to convince financiers that it was a good idea to invest in a feature-length film.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we knew that he wanted to shoot it in a very specific way. And I think that that was why this one was particularly lent itself to something where we could shoot a scene of it and say, here, look, this is the look of the movie. This is what, you know, J.K. Simmons is going to be like. And then that way it was very clear and we were all sort of able to see the same thing.
And you shot it in 19 days, and which is really, really fast for those that are not familiar with this process. How did that happen?
The problem that you get is when you don't have a lot of money, budgets for films tend to translate into the number of days you get. So, you know, the more money, the more days. And for us, we unfortunately didn't have the money to shoot much longer than that. And so we had to really be very diligent about our prep work, and so that we knew on any given day exactly what we were doing going in. And towards the end, there were some very, very, very long days, but we were lucky with a very talented crew.
Well, I read that the preparation for the film involved a lot of storyboards that Damien had ready. I mean, when I think of storyboards, I think of movies with a lot of CGI, maybe Lord of the Rings or something. But this is a really elaborate process that was already done before the shooting began.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was one of the most impressive things. He sent me, basically for the final sequence, he had storyboarded out every shot that he wanted based exactly on the song. So you knew at every note what you were looking at. And that was one of the most impressive things to see.
Can you tell me a little bit more about what pre-work was required to be ready the moment you got on set and to finish shooting so quickly?
Well, the biggest issue is we had to start with the dinner table scene. That was our first day of shooting, and normally you don't want to get into something that involves, because sitting around a dinner table, it looks deceptively easy, but that takes up the most time because you have to move the camera so much to get all the different angles. So they was planning out that and sort of knowing from day one we had to have everything overly planned, and then day two we did the car crash. So we really didn't have time to sort of ease into it in any way, and I think that having those two days as our first days be sort of so daunting, we knew we had to do everything we could beforehand.
What was the best part of having a 19-day production process?
The best part about it? I guess the sleep deprivation can only last so long.
And what was the worst?
The sleep deprivation.
Okay. So do you think your success with such a short shoot would encourage other filmmakers to do things the same way?
Not. I hope that people are able to get as much time as they possibly can for these things, but I do hope that it excites people to take more risks as far as the kinds of stories they want to tell and to figure out ways to do it, because I think that, you know, Damien had this script for a long time that was sent around to a lot of people who said no because they didn't see it on the page. My biggest hope from this is that it shows that there are new and different ways to get strange things made, that it's not just about sending your script and hearing no, but it's like, okay, if we're going to say no, then how do we get them to say yes, and what are the new and different ways we can do that?
But this is not certainly not the first time that a short film has helped produce a feature-length film.
Oh, absolutely not. No. They've done it for a ton of things, and I think we were really lucky in that we sort of had a very perfect scene to showcase, but I think also in general, it's very helpful for directors, any director starting out to do a short film, whether it's a part of their feature or not, just because I think that's the best way to sort of have a calling card and show people what you're capable of.
So for those who have not seen Whiplash, it focuses a lot on drumming and Miles Teller's actual skill as a drummer. So how much of this is him, you know, his actual skills, and how much of this involves a double or maybe, you know, fudging the music a little bit?
The majority of it is him. I mean, he's been drumming since he was 15, so he had to learn a slightly different way of holding the stick to do the traditional grip, which is different for jazz than it is for rock drumming. But obviously, there's some movie magic in there, but you'd be surprised at how much is really him.
And are a lot of these other supporting players, are they more musicians or actors?
For the most part, they're almost all musicians. The rival drummer, Nate Lang, who's his main rival, is a very accomplished drummer himself. And then almost all of the background people you see are real musicians, because we really wanted it to have an authentic feel and to be able to not look like we were faking it.
one of the other musicians in the scene is not in the scenes with the jazz band, but J.K. Simmons is playing piano in a club. Was that him actually playing?
Oh, yeah, that's him. I mean, J.K. has a degree in music. That was the beauty of all of this, too, is we got very lucky with actors who had the background. But, yeah, that's all J.K.
Well, let's talk about him, because if you read a lot of Oscar predictions, et cetera, a lot of people say he's a near lock for Best Supporting Actor. He's terrific in this role, but not the typical role that we know him for. So what made you decide to cast him?
Well, it's Jason Reitman who, as soon as I gave him the script to read, he said, oh, great, now we have the perfect role for J.K., which once he said that, it seems like such an obvious thing, but I think it wasn't obvious to all of us going into it. But I think J.K. is just he's a really incredible actor, and he's been doing this for years. And, you know, he was playing a horrible, evil Nazi on Oz at the same time that he was on Broadway with Guys and Dolls. So, you know, he's capable of doing all of these things almost nearly simultaneously. I think he's just such an amazing talent, and I was just so excited that he's getting the recognition that I think is well-deserved.
Well, I mean, we've seen him in roles like the dad in Juno in Farmers Insurance commercials, so might this kick some doors open for him? He's more than a character actor, maybe.
I certainly hope so, yeah. Yeah, it's been exciting.
There are some themes running throughout this movie about, you know, what does it mean to be great? And this character that Miles Teller plays is pushed so hard by this guy. Can you talk about the overriding theme in this movie?
Yeah, I think a lot of it has to do with what does it mean to be great? And I think a lot of it has to do with what does one give up? What does one sacrifice in one's life to pursue one's dreams? And I think that's sort of the big thing. I also think that there are obviously a lot of exploration of Fletcher's techniques and is it worth it to push someone that hard and does that actually help or does it hurt ultimately? And I think that there are a lot of different questions being asked in here, but for me it's sort of some of it is just sort of simply like what do you want to do with your life? How do you want to interact with the world and what is most important to you?
You're listed as a creative producer on this film, and what does that role entail?
Well, so it's a sort of funny way of articulating. So it's actually different for features and for TV. In features, if you have the title producer, that means you're sort of the one whose main person as far as putting it together. For TV, it's executive producer, the sort of top title, which is a funny little switch. But for me, I tend to be called a creative producer because it means I am involved in all sort of logistics and creative as far as from the beginning throughout the process. So creative producer mostly just means that it's to sort of distinguish between, for example, a line producer who is someone who really just runs production. For me, being a producer really just means shepherding the project all the way through and making sure that you're hopefully the one who's the voice for what's best for the film and trying to make it the best possible thing that it can be.
And how did you first meet Jason Reitman and come to work with him?
I started as his assistant, actually, many years ago. So my friend was working for his agent, and I interviewed. He had a different company. This was about over eight years ago. He had a different company then, and so I went and started working for them and then started reading and working on development, which just basically means I was helping them with working up scripts early on.
And how did you end up running the company?
The company before that had dissolved, and so about 6 years ago, we started Right of Way Films, and I was just brought over to do that.
You know, what was going through your head when you realized that you'd been nominated for an Oscar? I mean, is there any way to describe the exhilaration with that and that your film had four nominations on top of the Best Picture?
I have to be honest, it was completely surreal. It is still only sinking in, and I kept thinking for many days after that that someone was going to call me up and tell me they were just kidding. it is still very, very hard for me to believe. It's been a really fun time and a really fun process, but it was certainly a shock to say the least.
Are you able to come back to the Champagne very often?
Unfortunately, no. I come home every Christmas because that's when my family all gets together, and I try to get back at least one other time if I can, but unfortunately not nearly as much as I would like.
Well, I believe one of those times was you had a Q&A session after a screening of Whiplash when it was at the Art Co-op.
I did, which is so much fun. That was such a joy because, you know, I grew up on that theater, so being able to go back with a movie that I had made it was just something really special for me.
Any interesting questions come up for you there?
You know, I think it's a lot of, people were very thoughtful about it and sort of asking about both the process but also the product, and it was a real joy to talk to people about it.
I'm also interested in what kind of reaction to Whiplash you're getting.
You know, it's really running the gamut. I think that people have a lot of differing ideas on what the ending actually means, and that's one of the most fun things for me to hear, is people debate whether or not they think the ending is positive or negative, and whether it's triumphant or disturbing. So I think that we've been getting, but the exciting thing for me is we've just been getting a lot of sort of personal reactions where people feel very connected to the film in various ways. And you know, one of the greatest honors is when musicians come up to us and say that we got it right, which is nice. And but yeah, I think the sort of people finding anything that sort of personally connects to is always really exciting to me.
What does the ending mean to you personally?
I don't know. I didn't know the answer. That's why I wanted to ask the question.
What's the next project for you? What are you looking forward to next?
Well, I'm currently sitting in the production office of our TV show. We're doing 10 episodes of a TV show for Hulu, which we'll start shooting in about a month. So that's the next thing that we're actively in production on. And then I have a number of different scripts, mostly features, but another TV pilot too, but that we're getting ready, and we'll hopefully shoot at least one of those this fall.
Any chance you might come to Champaign to film?
I would love to. You know, my friend Daryl Wayne and Zoe Lister just shot their movie there and had the best time. So I was just talking to Daryl about it, and what he said that he had such an amazing, incredible time being in Champaign for a few months. And it was really wonderful to hear him talk about it, because, you know, he's from New York and been an independent filmmaker and shot all over. And so hearing about shooting in my hometown was a real thrill.
I'm wondering, there's been a change at the helm of the Illinois Film Office. I don't know if you followed that at all, or just the credits that filmmakers can get to come into a city like Champaign or even Chicago to shoot, if you followed that at all.
You know, I haven't followed the latest with Illinois specifically, but anytime that there's any sort of tax credits, that's where everyone goes. And I think that the exciting thing is it's starting to open up all over the country. You know, obviously Atlanta has become a huge place for people to go shoot because of the tax credits there, and New Orleans has been for a while. And I'm just hoping that, you know, we can open it up more and more, because it would be a dream to go back to Illinois to shoot.
Well, Helen Estabrook, thanks so much for your time. And you said there's a TV project coming up. Any other leaks on what we might be seeing from you in the near future?
Well, we just shot a movie in the fall called Demolition by a director named Jean-Marc Vallée. So that was a script that a dear friend of mine wrote that we've been trying to get together for a really long time now. So we're in the editing process of that, and hopefully you'll see that next year.
All right. Well, hope to have you sometime in the studios on one of your limited visits back to Champaign-Urbana.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Helen. We'll be watching Sunday and rooting for you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
We need to take a break now, but up next we'll talk with Chicago Tribune court reporter Jason Meisner about a current copyright case involving Finding Vivian Mayer, a Chicago-based Best Documentary nominee. Stay with us. Hello and welcome to this WILL radio special, Illinois at the Oscars. I'm Jeff Bossert. In early 2014, the buzz around the photography of Vivian Mayer began to grow with the release of Finding Vivian Mayer, a documentary from John Maloof and Charlie Siskel that traces the negatives from the auction where Maloof bought them in 2007 to her current art world fame. That fame attracted the attention of David Deal, who filed suit alleging copyright infringement. Jason Meisner is the federal courts reporter for the Chicago Tribune. He's covered the case for the Tribune and joined us by phone on Monday. Jason, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Well, can we start by laying out the key players in this case?
The documentary that's up for an Oscar was co-written and directed by a guy named John Maloof. He's he was a realtor in Chicago, and he was also a part-time writer, and he was writing a book about one of our Chicago neighborhoods, and he was looking for old photographs of the city. And he ended up buying a whole load of Vivian Mayer's stuff that was in a storage locker, and he started producing some of the negatives and realized that they could be good, and he started putting them online and got an incredible reaction. He owns about 90% of Vivian Mayer's negatives, over 100,000 of them. And so he's the one who's got the documentary where he lays out how he discovered her work and tries to track down her heirs, because she died penniless in Chicago in 2009. So there's just behind the scenes legal wrangling over what's going to happen.
Yeah, aggravated by the fact that she left no will, and they can't find the one brother they believe that was may no longer be with us.
Right. In this documentary, John Maloof hires genealogists, and they travel to France to look for relatives. He does uncover information about a brother, Charles, but the paper trail on him disappears in, talking about 60 years ago, so there's no indication that he's still alive. But they also don't know if Charles had any children, and if he did, there would be heirs out there who would have the legal rights to Vivian Meyer's work. So that's what's going on.
Well, we not only have John Maloof, but don't we have another art dealer involved here, someone else who's claimed the right to some of this material?
There's another guy in Chicago named Jeffrey Goldstein who had about 18,000 negatives. And because of this ongoing battle, which is now tied up in Cook County probate court and could be for years, Jeffrey Goldstein sold his negatives to a gallery owner in Toronto a couple months back against the wishes of the counties. So there's all sorts of stuff going on. There's also, you mentioned this David Deal. He's in Virginia. He's an attorney who says that he's a fan of Vivian Meyer's work, and he thought they were violating copyright law. So he kind of inserted himself in this situation and got this whole ball rolling last year by going to Cook County Probate Court and filing on behalf of a guy in France that he claims is a cousin to Vivian Meyer. So there's a lot of moving parts. And in the meantime, you got this documentary up for an Oscar that's getting a lot of attention. So nobody knows how it's going to shake out.
Well, yeah, it should be a really happy time as we prepare for the Oscars. But there's this dark cloud of a legal mess, you know, overshadowing all this.
Right. John Maloof, I interviewed him a couple times in the last few weeks, and he's just... He said exactly that. He said it should be the greatest time for him to get all this recognition, but to also with all this stuff up in the air in court, he's kind of caught between a rock and a hard place. He doesn't want to be seen as somebody who's really profiting off of her work because that's what a lot of people feel that he's doing. He's kind of trying to lay low, but at the same time, it's hard to lay low when you're up for an Oscar.
And he made a couple of legal mistakes along the way.
Yeah, I don't know if he would characterize it that way, but other people have told me, yes, he didn't do certain things. He thinks he did his due diligence in trying to find an heir and reaching an agreement with that person. But legally, because she died without a will, you really need to try to find out, are there other heirs out there? There needs to be a period where heirs have a chance to come forward. So that's basically what's going on now. The county got in control of the estate and is trying to figure out, are there other heirs, and possibly work out a deal with Maloof and other people who own the negatives to try to bring this to a resolution.
Well, how rare is this? We have a legal battle over someone who never told anyone that she was an artist in life and gave little indication that she wanted anyone to see any of this work.
There are so many aspects of this case that are unprecedented, just from a legal standpoint, also just from an artistic standpoint, that somebody would take all these photos, that they're so good, everybody agrees that they're excellent, and not tell anybody, and then it's only after she dies that they're recognized, and now you have this deal going on in Cook County Court where normally, obviously when they're dealing with an estate of somebody who had no will and no heirs, 99% of the time that estate has very little funds and they're just quietly settled. But in this case, we're talking about potentially millions and millions of dollars. And when there's millions of dollars involved in anything, it gets complicated.
Well, do you sense any regret in your time talking to Maloof about the way he's gone about this?
Yeah, I mean, he's a little... He doesn't want to come out and say, I'm sure he regrets some things about how it's played out. He's really upset about this. He takes the criticism to heart, and he doesn't, from his perspective, he has put a lot of time and money and effort into this to bring her photographs to life and promote them. And he's not trying to get rich off of it. He claims he's only recently begun to turn a profit because it's so time-consuming and expensive to print. These are old, obviously old negatives that you have to go through a special process to get printed and developed. So I'm sure he has regrets, but yeah, he's claiming that it's unfair, the treatment he's getting.
Anything new to report from the legal battle?
It's up in court in a couple of weeks in Cook County. Right now, everything is kind of behind the scenes. We had an article a couple of weeks ago about these behind-the-scenes negotiations where they basically are trying to reach a deal because the county has the legal right to the copyrights. But without the negatives, it's not really worth anything. And then from Maloof's standpoint, he has the negative, but without the copyrights, he can't produce and sell them at galleries and things like that. So something, it's going to come to a head. We just don't know how and when, but it could take months or years.
But we do have several exhibits out in this and other countries, if you go to the Vivian Meyer website right now.
Yeah, some of them have been taken down, and some were canceled. There was a big exhibit that was supposed to be in Moscow. The only one in Chicago that's still up that I know of is at the Chicago History Museum. They've been able to keep it up because they don't charge entry fee, and it's not for profit. But a lot of people are just scared, and they don't want to expose themselves to any kind of legal action by the county if they're found to be profiting from these images.
Well, what role, if any, would a Best Documentary Oscar play in this legal fight?
What role would it play? It doesn't really, other than it's brought a lot more attention to this, and there's a lot of people. I mean, if you go online and look at some of the reviews of this documentary, they are less than kind, because there's a certain element out there. People think that John Maloof, because he co-wrote and co-directed the documentary, they're saying it's just another example of how he thinks he's the story, when really it's Vivian Meyer who's the story, and that he's unfairly profiting and kind of puffing himself up to be the story.
Well, have you formed any opinion of her from the film and all this time covering the legal battles?
It's an unprecedented story. The fact that she was a Chicago nanny who had this uncanny eye for street photography and was able to get these kind of like shockingly intimate portraits of people. And there's a lot of people who wish they could find out more about her and what she was like. And so from that perspective, the documentary does a good job laying that out. But there's a lot about her we'll probably never know.
Hazard a guess what will happen ultimately, and I'm sure this will take a long time to play out in the courts.
I think they're going to come to some sort of deal, but whether that's going to be good enough for Maloof to take, Jeff Goldstein, the other guy who sold his negatives, told me like he would never in a million years, I believe the quote was he would cut his wrists before he would make a deal with Cook County, which is not known as a bastion of efficient government, so... The fact that they would be taking over a project, an art project, worth millions of dollars is bizarre to people and scary. I think it'll be resolved, but it's going to take a while.
You would expect someday John Maloof is given maybe due credit. Whether there's some criticism of how he went about his work, he still exposed this photography of this woman.
Sure. From his perspective, and it's a pretty fair argument that these negatives that he bought at a storage locker auction could have easily either gotten into the wrong hands or hands of somebody who had no idea what they were looking at, or maybe just thrown out. They could have been thrown in a dumpster, and then nobody would even know anything about Vivian Meyer. Nobody would have ever seen her photos. So that's where he's coming from. It's a fairly good argument, I think.
It would be interesting if the film did win, though. That's just exactly what Maloof would say on the stage come Oscar night.
Yeah, and what the reaction would be to some people in Chicago with this brewing behind the scenes, but I think it's bad timing for him, the exposure that it brings, but we'll see. He's up against some other very good documentaries, and of course in Chicago there's also an added element that his co-writer and director is the nephew of the movie critic Gene Siskel, and another documentary about Roger Ebert's life was passed over. John Maloof's movie made it, so there's that whole element going on.
Well, being in Urbana, the hometown of Roger Ebert, yeah, people are well aware of mm-hmm. life itself and the perceived snub of that film. So.
Right, right.
Best worst case for John Maloof?
Best case would be that the county offers him something where he's able to continue to develop the negatives that he has. He's got a whole trove of color film. Later in her life, Vivian Meyer switched to color film. Those negatives are sitting in a freezer in his office, and they're waiting just to be developed. So I think what he wants is for the county to, he knows they're going to be involved, but to let him continue doing his thing. And he may have to kick money into the estate in case an heir comes forward, but that would be his best case scenario. Worst case, there's lawsuits, there's subpoenas. They could hold him in contempt of court. All sorts of bad things can happen when high-powered lawyers get involved, and if there's millions of dollars at stake. He doesn't want to lose control of what he's got, so that would be the worst case scenario, is that he's ordered to just turn over his negatives.
And what are the best and worst cases for fans of Meyer's work?
For the fans, it's all about seeing the photos, right? So I think the worst case scenario, obviously, is that because of this legal battle, no one gets to see him. And the best case is that something has worked out. And really, for the fans, it all comes down to, who really cares? If somebody's making money off of it, hopefully it's the right person. But, that the best case scenario would be the photographs remain on display in galleries and museums across the world.
All right. Jason Meisner, federal courts reporter for the Tribune. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks a lot.
We need to take a break now, but up next, we'll talk with Austin McCann, general manager of the Art Theater Co-op in Champaign, and Julie Turnock, University of Illinois, assistant professor of media and film studies. We'll talk about film's diversity problem and a number of other Illinois connections at the Academy Awards. Stay with us. And we're back. Joining us in the studio is Julie Turnock. She's a professor of cinema studies at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. And Austin McCann is general manager of the Art Theater Co-op in downtown Champaign. They join us. Thanks to both of you for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
I want to talk a bit about some other themes related to the Oscars. First, we'll talk about Life Itself, the Roger Ebert documentary. It had a lot of popularity in this region, Roger Ebert's hometown. Yet, despite all the buzz, not nominated for a Best Documentary Oscar. There was a formalized Oscar campaign for this movie. It made a short list of the top 15 that were nominated to be nominated for an Oscar. But director Steve James has also had a history of not being nominated. Like each of you, I guess first Austin to weigh in on why you feel it didn't make the final list.
I'm not sure that I have a clear reason why Life Itself wouldn't be nominated for Best Documentary. There was a piece in the Sun-Times considering the possibility of maybe the documentary committee just thought that the other five films were better. I don't feel that way about this documentary lineup. I know Hoop Dreams was one of the biggest controversies in Oscar history, prompting them to completely change the way that movies got nominated in the documentary category so they would actually have documentary filmmakers on there. Roger Ebert wrote a great piece at the time, basically accusing the Academy of being less interested in cinema verite or documentaries that are filming events as they're happening rather than the past tense talking head style of documentary that year. But anybody who's familiar with the work of Steve James found this a huge shock. The response to Life Itself is overwhelmingly positive. I personally can't account for it.
Is there an argument that Steve James doesn't need a nomination? I think you've come up with a list of some of the top documentary filmmakers around the country, the top five. He'd probably be on the list. And maybe he's getting more attention because he wasn't nominated.
For me, this is an ongoing question of what significance do we want the Oscars to have? For me, it's less about feeling that the Oscars are in tune with aesthetic quality and more in terms of how does it move resources towards those filmmakers who are awarded Oscars. So for Steve James, who turned out Hoop Dreams, The Interrupters, Life Itself, and keeps not getting nominated, clearly his films are getting out there, they're finding an audience, but it would always be good to see what these filmmakers were able to do if they would have the complete amount of resources at their disposal.
Julie, what were your thoughts on the snub of Life Itself?
I agree with Austin. I saw the film at Ebert Fest this last year and really enjoyed it. Thought it was a really excellently made documentary, very affecting. It's in good company, though. The Academy has a strange, long history of not nominating the most well-known and popular documentaries of the year, and I don't really have a reason behind why that happens. On one hand, you know, the Oscars mean more prestige for these filmmakers, and it matters from that point of view. But at the same time, there may be an upside to the controversy of not having been nominated and getting more attention to the work through the controversy that it wasn't nominated.
Selma might be in that same case as well.
Right.
We'll the conversation.
We'll have to touch on Selma as well. Is there any chance that the Academy is getting back at Roger Ebert for bad reviews?
Maybe.
I wouldn't be able to comment on that.
But I mean, the Oscars, some of those snubs seem a little petty, but it's hard for us to know because Julie and I are not members of the Academy.
And you look at the list of documentary nominees. You have Citizen Four about Edward Snowden, Vibing Vivian Mayer. We'll get to that in a moment. And Last Days of Vietnam, Virunga, a movie about guerrillas. I mean, in the past years, the movies that have won Best Documentary, you have historical context, maybe international cybersecurity issues, those kinds of things. Is there a chance that the themes of these movies are the reason Life Itself got shut out, that we're looking for something more significant?
Citizen Four is an amazing film, so I understand that one being nominated, but it's hard. I mean, Steve James, when interviewed recently, was saying the documentary is no longer a marginal film, so the fact that we're also being forced to choose between five films is a little arbitrary, considering Best Picture can go up to 10. The documentary, to me, is kind of an unstable format. People aren't sure what makes a good documentary, and in the way that people are more familiar talking about what makes a good film for a narrative feature. So, I'm not sure.
Well, we're going to turn to one of the other documentary films lucky enough to receive a nomination. Just mentioned it a moment ago. Finding Vivian Maier tells the story of a Chicago-based nanny who kept her incredible skill as a photographer secret, and we only discovered her photos after John Maloof purchased many of them at a storage locker sale. Austin, I understand you're not much of a fan of the film.
I think Vivian Maier's work is amazing. The puzzle documentary, this is a certain kind of popular documentary. For me, these are films that remind me a lot of a story you can hear on Radiolab. And basically, there's a kind of narrative which you are being given, and there are little clues that you're being given throughout the film. So in Finding Vivian Maier, what the film is about, and this is coming out in the lawsuits that you're seeing about the film, is where does value come from in art? Because the question, this is another one of these reclusive genius films. Vivian Maier took these amazing photographs. Why didn't she want to put her work out there and claim her status as one of the great photographers of the 20th century? But the strangeness and the pettiness and the power that's evident in the art market and the art world that comes through in that film, I think, answers more questions than the movie is really willing to contend with. And comparing that film to Life Itself, I just find Finding Vivian Maier to be a more shallow film. It's something that I watched, I enjoyed, but at the end, I'm not sure that it's going to be a film that we are going to return to continually want to unravel what it means for the medium and what it means for the subjects in the story.
Selma played at the Art Theater. Well, why don't we start with you, Julia? I mean, what were your thoughts when it only turned up with nominations for Picture and Best Song?
I was surprised on one hand, but on the other hand, Ava DuVernay doesn't have a long track record with the Academy, and oftentimes there's a sense that you're working your way up into being considered for Oscars. For example, like the Coen brothers start small and then they eventually have enough attention. At the same time, it is a long-standing problem with the Academy that, you know, they're in fact working within their own ranks to try to deal with the kind of problem of diversity within the Academy votership. I've got a few numbers here that, and this is from 2012, so they're not going to be exactly correct, but 94% of the Academy is white, 77% of the Academy is male, and 54% of the Academy is over the age of 60. And so that tends to skew the voting in certain directions. Also, 20% of the Academy is the actors branch. The kind of movies that awards tend to be ones that play to that demographic. And it's not to say that Selma doesn't play to that demographic, but I think, and also there's been a lot of press about how Paramount, I mean, it's a studio film, it's not an independent film, how Paramount's, the studio, mishandled its Academy campaign, that they didn't send screeners for the Guild Awards, but only for the Oscars and maybe one other of the major awards, I think the Golden Globes. And so it's hard to tell whether it is a kind of purposeful snub, and to what extent it was a kind of mishandling of the Oscar campaign.
Julie, Cheryl Boone Isaacs is now head of the Academy. We have an African-American woman. You know, what does that say?
It says that the Academy is really concerned about their image, and they should be. And so I think it's a positive step forward for the Academy to acknowledge that they have this kind of demographic problem. And even if it's maybe cosmetic at this point, I think she's a fine leader for the Academy. But it's important that they know that there is a problem with perception.
So we've been talking about who it is that we're seeing on screen, and the question of particularly the growing Chinese film market is very significant. But the fact that movies are making a huge amount of money in China doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to be seeing non-white people on screen. You know,
that's for sure.
The Romanian film, I mean, in Romania, they are turning out like masterpiece after masterpiece in that country. But those movies are mostly being seen in art houses in New York and L.A. You know, in a lot of other countries, what they want to see is Iron Man. They want to see these big movie explosions. Now they're having these, I think, really chauvinistic discussions about, well, you know, are non-American countries ready for a female-led Ghostbusters? So there are growing demographics. I mean, there's a huge Latin American and Latino population growing in the United States. I think that, you know, the National Association of Theater Owners, who they manage the multiplexes, they're trying to figure out who is this audience and what kind of movies do they want to see. But that, combined with the fact of overseas, you know, the huge amounts of revenue that they're seeing generated by movies like Iron Man, I think is interesting to see what is going to be funded going forward. I don't particularly have a lot of hope for it that we're going to be seeing better films coming out of it. My sense is more that we're going to be going more and more towards monolithic, big budget action movies and then the independent stuff that, you know, obviously is our lifeblood, and by our I mean the art theater, is going to be increasingly on television. Mm-hmm. I think it's a weird moment in the industry, and I'm not trying to sound a death of cinema null or anything, but I know that those are growing concerns that we have not yet figured out.
Well, and the economics of the situation are stark, unfortunately. When there was the controversy over Ridley Scott's Exodus for not having ethnically appropriate actors, all white stars, Ridley Scott said in an un-PC way, I can't cast an unknown actor in this role. It won't play anywhere. I need these big stars for it to play around the world. And it's unfortunate that it's true, that it's a vicious cycle because they don't try to cast anything but stars for these kind of big blockbuster roles. Then the perception is that they can't. And same with if you don't have a female director with a track record for making big blockbusters, they think women can't direct big blockbusters. And so it's a vicious circle of replicating what has succeeded in the past.
This was an interesting question for me, too, with Selma, because I would say largely due to Ava having a greatly reduced budget compared to what a different director would get. She had a lesser-known cast, which I think actually benefited the film in a lot of ways. She has a really strong relationship with David Oyelowo, who was in Middle of Nowhere, the really beautiful film she released before Selma, and they're working on projects going forward. The one complaint I heard from people at the art about Selma was that they found the presence of Oprah a little distracting.
But Oprah was great in it,
I said,
actually.
Hey, yeah, and, you know, I mean, despite what you think about it, she's the executive producer on that thing. Oprah Winfrey is making things happen for Ava DuVernay, so we can give her this one. I think, yeah, it's a question, too, of, like, how the director is seeing their limitations. Like, do I want this film to have the biggest audience possible, making the most money possible, or what kind, or do I want an appropriate representation that won't be distracting from the story that we're telling? And I'm not saying what they should decide there. I just know those are concerns for different directors.
The criticisms of how Lyndon Johnson characterized, questionable whether he said some of the things he did and what happened at that period, would that hurt the film at all?
Well, I agree with Ava DuVernay that she's being held to a level of truth that other filmmakers have not been. Also, I mean, there's a lot of unpleasant historical material about Lyndon Johnson out there in the world, and it was a pretty respectful characterization as far as I was concerned. If she wanted to characterize him as a villain, she had historical material to use to do that. She is as free to make artistic license as anyone else.
I agree with, you know, what great commentators have been saying, that this is a film about a black social movement that made social change happen in the United States, and that a lot of white people got really uncomfortable with that. What this film showed is that Lyndon B. Johnson did the right thing after he was forced to by a black social movement. Selma is much more an on-the-ground, these are the people doing the work, this is what they look like, and you're going to have a much more contentious relationship with power. Selma was a huge hit for us. People were very moved by it. I understand there could be a lot of reasons why Selma would be left out. The powerful thing for me was seeing how moved people were to critique when Selma was snubbed, particularly the inclusion of the even aesthetically problematic film American Sniper. For me, it was very powerful to see people being moved by this because I saw them genuinely wanting different kinds of representations on screen than they normally have access to and wanting those to be rewarded. The pain that I saw was very touching to me because I also got to see, oh, this is still a medium that people are invested in. And there is still some space for significance for us when we're talking about film. And I saw that unlike previous years with the Oscars, this was a very political discussion this year, which I think is good for the art form.
Well, this brings up another topic, and the lack of roles for women. A lot of people like the performance, Reese Witherspoon in Wild. Difficult for women as they become 30 and older to find roles or roles that maybe the Oscar deems worthy of nomination.
And Tina Fey and Amy Poehler's joke at the Golden Globe I thought was so good about Patricia Arquette in Boyhood, proving there's still great roles for women over 40 as long as they're hired when they're under 40.
Or for roles for people who aren't Meryl Streep. Mm-hmm. Meryl Streep's over 40. You know, so bringing in Ava DuVernay as a perceived snub in the director's category, so is Angelina Jolie, for that matter, for Unbroken, which, whether you like the movie or not, it's a very typical Oscar-type story, and actors who go the directorial route are very frequently awarded by Oscar. And so we're talking about Oscars, but at the same time, you know, we have to advocate as consumers as well. So we have to go to the movies and pay and vote with our wallet and go see movies by Ava DuVernay and Angelina Jolie and other non-traditional filmmakers.
It's been documented that Reese Witherspoon had to form a production company in order to make the film that she wanted to see made, and it's something that, certainly not a glamorous role that she got a lot of praise for.
I don't know that much specifically about that particular example, but I do know that a lot of actresses, especially both for TV and in film, are forced to kind of take things into their own hand in order to find roles for themselves. That especially, I think we've already mentioned, once you get out of the ingenue or girlfriend age bracket, which is pretty young in Hollywood, it's you hit 35 and you're starting to lose out to younger actresses, that this is what Drew Barrymore has done. This is what Angelina Jolie has done and lots of Hollywood actresses.
I would just say in terms of representation, too, it feels to me like this is the year that the Bechdel test is more breaking out into the mainstream. And the Bechdel test, named after the great MacArthur Genius Prize award winning cartoonist, author Alison Bechdel. That's a way of basically gauging the quality of representation of women in a film or TV. And I'm trying to remember what they specifically are. You have to have two characters who are women, who have names, who talk to one another about something besides men. And this isn't an objective thing necessarily, because you can dispute, like, well, does that character really have a name or not? They might have a name in the credits, but does anybody use it?
Iron Man 3 passes the Bechdel test, actually.
Okay, so like, so it's not like necessarily a stamp of this is, you know, a revolutionary feminist film, but I think it's a good way for people to start thinking about representations of people who have historically been marginalized in at least American film, which is everybody but straight white men.
I'm also thinking about another common trend in the industry is movies that we see in the nominations are released late in the year. And if you look at what's playing right now with multiplexes, they catch up on some Oscar-nominated material and then a lot of January, February releases that, quite frankly, aren't very good. Is this a problem, though, if you release one of the really good movies early in the year?
I think that's objectively the case, that, you know, movies that are coming out starting in November. I mean, at the Art Theater, we know that is Oscar season. Even January tends to be Oscar season for us. Now, this year has some huge exceptions with Grand Budapest, which came out in March, and Boyhood, which came out, I think, early in the summer. But, you know, IFC knows when they're releasing Boyhood, we are hurting this film's chances releasing it at this point, even though Boyhood was kind of an unstoppable force.
You know, over and over again, we talk about how this is an issue and nothing real changes. Is there any expectations we'll see? Is Oscar season always going to be Oscar season year?
Well, I mean, it has already changed to a certain degree. What you're asking is whether movies will be recognized by the Academy, released at different times of year. But it's interesting to me that March and April, especially, are starting to turn into big release times of the year, both for what we might call less traditional blockbusters like the Hunger Games franchise, for example, or Twilight franchise, but also Scorsese films have been coming out, like Shutter Island, I think, came out in March or something of its year, just as an example. And so the release schedule, because the summer season is so tight with blockbusters, and you've got blockbusters that are scheduled for every weekend of the summer for the next several years already. Now, in order to find an audience, film the studios and the independents are finding other times to release throughout the year.
There's never a shortage of great movies, ever. There's always a great film that I haven't played that is a new release. The question is there an audience for it or not? Maybe the really mainstream big budget films that are coming out, and far be it from me to have a critique of 50 Shades of Grey, that might be the case, but there's always great films out there. It's just a matter of the conversation about movies that is mostly being promulgated by the corporate media. What are they saying is significant and what are they saying is insignificant? And from a programming standpoint, how can I convince our audience, hey, seeing a movie in April is just as good as seeing one in December?
Is there any chance we can vote with our dollars? Will making a point to go see movies help?
It's generally credited with Spike Lee that the only important color in Hollywood is green. And so if we want to see Ava DuVernay, for example, make more movies, we have to support her with our dollars. Or if we want to see more diversity in filmmaking, it's the movie business, and you know, business keeps it going. So I don't know if it will sway awards, but it will certainly sway what is being made because Hollywood follows success with replication.
Something I want to touch on here, talked about the business, and the Illinois Film Office recently changed directors. Political appointee from Governor Bruce Rauner, the director is now Christine Dudley. Bessie Steinberg is out. Dudley is a longtime Republican political consultant. It's the first purely political appointment that the office has seen. I mean, under Becky Steinberg, we had projects shot around Chicago like Transformers, The Dark Knight, and the TV show Empire. Any thoughts? I mean, there's been a little film work in Champaign. Any thoughts from either of you about the future of Illinois' prominence and being a place to come shoot films, Chicago or otherwise?
Yeah, I can say that it has been a really fruitful time under the previous Ms. Steinberg. And so it would be a shame if things didn't keep going in the same direction.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think Chicago's a great location for big budget films, and it's been great to see that city be used for that. And I know it's a great revenue generator, but let's just see what happens with this appointee.
All right. Well, Austin McCann, general manager of the Art Theater Co-op in Champaign, Julie Turnock, professor of cinema studies at the U of I. Thanks, both of you, for joining us today.
Thanks.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a WILO radio special, Illinois at the Oscars. Today's program was produced by Amanda Huntingfort with help from Jason Croft and Scott Cameron. Thanks for listening. I'm Jeff Bossert.